You know, there's an idea that all rappers should be really technically gifted, and when they move over a rhythm, you got to be strict, hit every beat, you know, every syllable has to be meticulous. But there's much more. Like, you look at artists like Kendrick Lamar, who's opened the door for this again. But then you got artists like Mike, sometimes Navy Blue. There's a bunch of them, Marvy. There's others. And at times, they will... It's almost a deliberate thing that they'll non-align with the beat. They'll kind of go out of flow of the beat. And sometimes, you know, people have to start realizing that that isn't a sign that those MCs are whack. Like, it isn't a sign that they're not technically adept. What they're doing is they are putting feelings and that ideas and emotions over technical ability. Killer Keller podcast. Killer Keller official.com.
Street Culture TV.
Beatbox created.
Killer Keller.
And we're here to talk about world music and street culture.
Killer Keller podcast.
Those are the things you learn, you know.
Yeah, I guess it is a learning process. It's a learning curve, isn't it?
Time, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, let's get into it.
Wow. Yes. Yo, ladies and gentlemen, Killer Keller podcast, live and direct, central London, or as central as you need to be. Choose to be. God damn it, you don't want to be anywhere else. It'd be criminal. Plus, you can't afford it. Energy prices and all that.
Get yourselves ready for the upcoming HODL Wars. It's time to graph punks up and get up with some NFT gaming. Also, big shout out to Chief Rocker Gear, from streets to stage. Chief Rocker is the streetwear of champions.
Anyway, look, big shout out to all the sharers and carers, people that are involved, moving and shaking and passing the seed of knowledge, which is the podcast. Subscribe, do the thing, and if you want more of the thing, go to the Keller Vision app. Free download, iPhone, Android, for all your sport and art, street culture, bits and bobs. We are talking MCing. We are dealing with a scientist, a wordsmith, the MC's MC. You know what I mean? We're going deep into this one like never before. If there's one person I know personally that embodies ultimately what MCing is about, it's this man here, hidden in the darkness, coming to light right now. Cannons the EP, and we have Nottingham's finest capo in the place.
Ooh. What's good, Keller? How you My doing? Thank brother. You for the introduction.
Come on, we're out here. Travel down as well.
Yes, yeah, in the torrential rain. Hazardous. Signals of climate change.
Yeah. It's hazardous.
Yeah, it was all right, you know. It looks hazardous, but yeah, it's amazing how secure you can feel when you're in a metal box surrounded by glass traveling at 90 miles an hour. It's amazing how you can just switch lanes without in torrential rain without really caring about the consequences. Fuck
that. Like aquaplaning all the way. Yeah.
I did see a car flipped on its roof as well.
Stop it.
Yeah, yeah. But there was somebody stood next to it on their phone.
Scratching their head.
Yeah. And the ambulance was there, but it looked like... I made up the story in my head that was the survivor. They'd crawled out and just phoned their mum or something. They're like, "Mum, I'm still coming home for Christmas." Imagine that as the Christmas gift. Like, I survived.
For Christmas. I survived Christmas 2023.
Yeah. Aquaplaning home for Christmas.
Aquaplaning. See what I'm saying? Like, lyricism. One of the most humblest and sweetest humans, but an absolute fucking beast when it comes to word creating rap. Like, it's... Bonker. I put you in the higher echelon. I'm just saying, I put you in a higher echelon as from seeing you as a youngster. We used to rock, you know, whenever we're going to Nottingham, check Capo. Whenever we're out on tour, who was it we were with? We were El Fudge, wasn't it?
El Fudge in Portugal.
In Portugal.
Yeah. It's good days. Good days.
Yeah. You know. But you've always been on it like that. You've always been. It's almost like leave Capo alone. Let him get on it over there and he'll just deliver fucking bars. That's you. I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a sport.
I think nowadays it's much more clear to me in the past decade that writing rhymes or that art form of writing is like a cathartic process. It's medicinal. Like, and I talk about that on Canon quite a lot, the new LP. I talk about the fact that music is a form of escapism for a lot of people, but I can notice, especially in the last decade, I notice when I've had a break from writing. You know, when life gets in the way of your art form and you have maybe a week or two, and you think, okay, I'll put the writing on the back burner. You've got family obligations, you've got work obligations, you've got other financial obligations. And then a couple of weeks in, I start to notice that I have a negative mind state. Like there's the shroud, like the cloud starts to lower. And then you get 3 or 4 weeks in. Like I think I'm about 3 or 4 weeks in now, and I can just tell as a human being, I'm just becoming erratic, negative, you know. And it's because I don't have that half an hour. I don't allocate that half an hour in my day to write. If I write, then, you know, I don't necessarily find a map out of elements of mental health decline. But if I write, just something implicit, something happens. I lock in. I'm able to say a word that links with my soul or whatever, and then I just feel better. You know, it's a cathartic process. I walk out of my outhouse where I write or the studio, and I just feel better. Sometimes, you know, the music never comes to light, but it's a process I have to go through. You know, whether it's successful or not, it's a process I have to go through.
I think that's something, first of all, so much to take away from that. But as somebody that enjoys the sport, but also sees it as, like you say, medicinal. It's therapy. It's a form of...
Yeah, it's definitely therapy, yeah.
Dude, that's every MC's dream, to be totally obsessed, fully engaged with the art.
Yeah, I think so. I think, yeah, I'd agree.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's break it down. And, you know, I'm going to jump straight to it because I want to know the day in the life of Kappa. Because if we're talking about... the day in the life of a lyricist, we're getting into this. Right, so what? Tell me how's your day structured?
Well, I was talking to somebody about this recently, about, because when you asked me about a day in the life, all of a sudden I had those millisecond thoughts about giving things away, you know, like giving insights away that may weaken my resolve tomorrow.
Oh, I love it. This is a military mind step right here.
Well, there's an author called Ernest Hemingway, and he said don't speak too much about the writing process. You know, he's super prominent writer in the modernist era in the early 1900s or, you know, 1920s. Mm. But he said something like it really stuck with me. He said this line. I was telling somebody recently, and he said, don't talk about the art process too much, because what you do as a writer, you take away the pattern of the feathers on a hawk's wing, or you take away the pollen from a butterfly's wings. It's that detail. You take away the sheen off the top if you talk about it too much. So I'm afraid to talk about my...
Like the ozone layer having like a crack in it or a hole in it. It's like, it's easier for people to get through your shield.
It's easier to get through the shield and to work somebody out if you want to be... have an element of mystique. But the other thing is, I think what he was getting at is that when you start talking about it too much, you don't do it. Mm-hmm. And the next time you go back to it, it's like, oh, like you're writing from another perspective. Whereas if you don't talk about it, just get on with it, which is maybe why there's that assumption that I'm really prolific, maybe, you know, that I write and write and write. And it, like you were saying at the beginning, like just let him get on with it.
Yeah.
That type of thing is more than likely because I'm a little bit afraid of giving away what is important to me, you know.
Do you know how rare that is? Because, you know, you've sustained a hearty career, you know, only in the MC lane, give or take, but I'm pretty. Mm. A couple of collaborations, a bunch of collabs, I remember. Hold Tight Heavy Bronx, actually.
Yeah.
That was bad boy, that was sick. It's just that you have managed to carve out this career, and in the shadows, I don't think it's that. It's that you've stayed absolutely true to your core and what your principles are for emceeing. And I get the feeling that the competition you have, the invisible competitor in your mind, which is most like you. It's probably you do measure up, and I guess there's an expectation that all MCs should be like that in your mind.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I think nowadays, especially, you know, MCs have an obligation to be personalities. You know, from my era, I think my era and the previous era, maybe two generations before me, it was. The emphasis was on lyricism and the craft of being an MC, you know, from Rakim onwards, I'm you know, I assume. Up until maybe early millennium when, you know, social media really started taking a hold. And then there was much more of a responsibility to be an all-round personality, to have other strings to your bow, so to speak. You know, I think it's to my detriment that I concentrate on just the MCing.
Why?
Well, it depends on what you think is detriment or is a negative element of your career. But yeah, I think I wouldn't say it's negative. It's just that it's the thing that I do. It's my lane, and like I say, it's medicinal for me or it's therapeutic for me. So it's what I have to do, and if I've come to terms with that, and that makes it okay that I haven't made, you know, monetary success where I can sit back and think, okay, where do I go with my legacy now? I'm still chasing that financial legacy. You know what I mean? I'm still. I think a problem that a lot of artists have, you know, wholesome artists, I think that's the wrong word to say wholesome, but artists who put the art first and foremost to the forefront, sometimes they do that to their detriment, I think, you know, so they don't worry of the elements of music and law and business behind music is an afterthought. You know, what you want to do, what you prioritize is the music first. So you make sure that is as high up in your estimations or your perfectionist mind state as possible. But then, and then you release it, but then you don't take care of everything that's in the background. There's so much, like, in the background of music business. You know, all of those organizations and corporations that you have to adhere to, and you can easily, like, there was not anybody telling me, look, you need to get your business covered. Like, people have always said, you know, I've minded my craft and I've been, you know, up there with my skill set, and I like to release products that have longevity, hopefully, and, you know, that sound good. But nobody really was pushing me. Not that I'm blaming or moaning anybody, but nobody was there saying, you need to get your business covered because in 20 years' time, what's your legacy going to look like? Do you know what I mean? I'm thankful that after 20, 25 years of releasing music, that I'm still able to do it. Because I know that there's others who are just as much perfectionists as me, just as much craftspeople of this art form who aren't able to do it anymore because life has gotten in the way, you know, and they weren't able to negotiate the business. They weren't lucky enough to be able to negotiate the business. The business is, you know, it's a complex thing, and I think it's almost, what would it be? It would, in language terms, it would be an oxymoron, like artist and business person. There's only people like Jay-Z, you know, but there's many people who are artists and business people, but you know, in that lane, I think it's quite rare to be able to be successful in both camps.
Yeah, you're right. In taking Jay-Z as a case in point, do you feel, you know, not that you'll want to critique these levels, but you'll hear certain things in tracks like someone like Jay-Z. Can you hear a lack of anything because he split his head between business and, for instance, and I picked Jay-Z through what you said because, you know, the mythology of Jay-Z is he walks in and he just freestyles his way through a track and then he walks out and then learns it later for live or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, can you hear that where he's not putting a hell of a lot of devotion to the craft itself?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. With somebody like that, I put him up there as if, you know, one of, if not the greatest rapper, MC of all time because of that, because of what you're saying, you know, that effortlessness, the truthfulness, the honesty, the delivery is it's changed over time. Patterns and flows have changed over time, but you always know it's him. And there's, I think, for some early on in their career, they can put on airs and graces. Like, I've done it. You know, you put an American twang on your voice or you put effort in to try and shape your voice too much. And then every time that you step to the microphone, it's not you, genuinely you speaking through the words. And I think, you know, it's taken me 20 years to be able to do that, you know, to look myself in the mirror and think, you know what? Like, what you need to be able to do is when you speak on the microphone, you need to be able to say the things you need to say like you would do off the mic, you know. But then again, that's that's contradictory as well, because you look at somebody like Annie Lennox from Eurythmics. You know, she speaks in a heavy, I think it's Glaswegian or a Scottish accent when she speaks, but then when she's on stage, she's got this beautiful, elegant, eloquent singing voice. And that's in some ways that's understandable, because this that's not, again, not that I'm equating myself to somebody like that, but I understand now, after 25 years of doing this thing, that what can happen to you if you have a broad accent.
Mm.
Like, England is all about class, you know, and as soon as somebody has embraced or has a strong accent, especially from the north, people make those assumptions like, oh, this guy's from the gritty up north, you know. So and then a lot of artists, they have to play that lane. They might not necessarily feel like they're...
Or want to, but because of the vocabulary...
Yeah, the perception of people who hear it, it's like, oh, well, they hear that accent, that's the class they're from. Mm. They have to play the working class person from the Midlands. They have to play that role, which is, you know, I get it. But somebody like Annie Lennox, did she, early on, was she told, or did she herself individually think, you know what, I am going to narrow my prospects of having a global career if I sing in a Glaswegian accent?
It's true.
Yeah.
Am I gonna regionalize myself?
You regionalize yourself, and then at some points, you know, in some ways that's of benefit.
Yeah.
In other ways, you can't escape that.
No.
You know, I say in a recent lyric, like, product of the place I was born, there's no escaping. Hear it in my voice and tell it from the way I speak.
Yeah.
You know, it's and when you realize that, it took me a long time. Like, I'm 44. It took me till 44 to realise that what I've been chasing is that regional thing.
Yeah.
And now I want to break out of that, but you know...
I have to... Right, so there's a couple of things that we can dissect off from that. This whole statement is a treasure trove of conversation. Right, so first of all, you mentioned Flo. Flo from Jay-Z. Now, he's certainly one of a character that people... You can hear... As soon as someone opens their mouth, who they're influenced by, right? There was this period of DMX where all of a sudden everyone was sounding a bit DMX-y. Mm. I remember when Talib Kweli came out and everyone started copying his flow, his pattern, his word pattern. And more recently, Kendrick Lamar, people copying that pattern. Dank, dank, de, dank, de, dank, 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 you know? Mm. Real simplified stuff. And with you and Nottingham, you've got... There's a tonality to... The delivery of the lyrics, that it just fits. In my humblest opinion, I've said it from the jump, Nottingham has a better accent for rapping. It just does. It does. And you can hate me, London, because I love you all. It's the truth. I've always had a feeling. It's the way that you guys roll the words, and you can afford to say class.
Mm.
Because, and that, from an American standpoint, is the same as
rappers. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it might have links with that, yeah.
Yeah.
It, like, has, although it does sound distinctly different from an American accent, but yeah, you know, somebody from America will say class, like us, whereas if you're from London, maybe you say class.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's true.
So that's why I've always had this, yo, like, Nottingham, it's just a hotbed of just skills. And
yeah. I have said in the past about the Nottingham accent and how I've relied on an accent quite heavily, because there's times when, like you were talking about flows, how people inherit flows. Mm. Like, I recently did a PhD in that area.
PhD, you know?
Yeah, I did.
PhD.
I undertook a thesis that was based, chapter three was based around this idea of lyrical performative quotation. It looked into Kendrick Lamar, and although it didn't talk about this, like, taking flows from each other, it talked about, he's got a track, I'm going down a rabbit hole. He has a track called Good Kid, Mad City, and as part of that track, when he first starts to speak as this character within the track, he has this wavering kind of tremulous tone of voice, almost in a way to try and project this idea of PTSD, of what is the struggle or what circumstance this character is in. It evokes that. And after that, in the 2 years afterwards, there were several artists, emerging artists, who undertook that. Like, they performatively quoted that quavering voice in order to evoke that same sense of trauma or that same sense of post-traumatic stress disorder in that way. But what I'm, so that's a lyrical performative quotation. So, you know, I have an understanding of how MCs borrow from each other. Yeah, there's it's deeply inherent in hip-hop culture. It's innate, that it's an open source culture that you give and you take. You know, you take quotes and you gain power from other people's quotes and they take yours, you know.
Open source, bruv.
Yeah.
And a cheap to enter one at that. Like, you better be fucking good, man. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
If you're going to take, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Pattern up.
Yes, yeah. But the other thing that I think I've relied on quite heavily over my career is that, yeah, I think all MCs, they borrow from each other, pay homage. And yeah, flows, I think, are important. You know, there's artists like Nas, Kendrick Lamar, like all of those artists that you're talking about, at some point they were so prominent that most artists took notice and started to envelop that into their practice. But I think one thing that you can do is if you've got a broad accent, or you can rely on that accent to cover up the edges of how much you're taking.
That's right.
So, for instance, what, 10, 15 years ago it must have been, Rick Ross came in and he had this almost what I would deem as a new type of flow where he'd leave a lot of gaps. Mm. You know, the sentences would be complex, but then you'd have a gap to almost process what he was saying. And then he'd, you know, that big breathing space, then he'd elaborate going further. And I took that on. I liked that flow, so I took it on. But I did it with respect. But another element that masks that whole imitation and adaptation and revision process is when you put the accent on, it takes away that direct link. You know, because there's no, I don't have the same accent as him. Maybe if I had the same accent, I tried to take directly from his. Do you know what I mean? It would be more than homage. It would be imitation, and then you start getting into muddy waters.
Influence is a real tightrope of a walk, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, I think. Yeah, yeah. I think that there are ways you can do that with respect. I think, you know, the whole hip-hop culture, b-boying and graffiti, all of the art forms, I think you can take influence, but it's almost as if you have to implicitly pay your respects at the same time, but then also put your own spin on it, you know? So I came up with it's a poorly developed term or concept for that process, which I'd say it's study, imitate, recreate, then master. So first of all, you're passionate, you obsess over somebody's flow, say, or you obsess over somebody's dance patterns if you're a b-boy. Then you imitate, you know, naively just try and imitate and try to reach a point where you feel like you're on a level with them and having an understanding of the angles that they may be pushing or you know, the angles that they may be stopping at whilst they're moving. Then you put your own spin on it. Then you start to recreate it in your own image. You know, find something that makes it distinctly yours as well as theirs, and then you master it. You know, that's when the final product is there, and then you can show it to the world, because it's like, right, I've done enough now that I'm not just imitating. You know, I'm being influenced, but I'm showing the I'm pushing it further. I think that's what hip hop culture's always done. That's what the competitive element is. It's pushing things further. You know, that's
talking to a master here. Fucking loving this. I was just like, yo, just keep this thing recording, man. It's incredible. Finally get a chance to talk to Capo. Crazy. All right, so who do you obsess with? I mean, you talk about obsessiveness and emceeing. Who have you, without giving too much away, because we don't want that to in any way be, you know, detrimental to, your influence of that person, but who recently have you, as a case study, just sat there and done nothing but listen to them?
I was lucky enough during the PhD process to be able to study Nas, Kendrick Lamar, and Earl Sweatshirt, emerging artists like Mike and Navy Blue, and how they, you know, one of the themes that leads throughout the doctorate or the thesis, the critical chapters of the thesis, is how they use certain literary techniques or, you know, performative techniques in order to articulate trauma. You know, Nas is one of the early examples that I talk about. You know, Nas is from like 94. You know, that's a long time ago now. And at that point in rap music in particular, it was hyper-masculine, you know. So speaking about your vulnerabilities, you have to do it short and sharp. Like, everything else has to prove, like, your exterior, that hard exterior. But every now and again, you give the listener, the proactive listener, you give them a glimpse into your makeup. Whereas somebody like Lamar steps in and they are able to perform under these different cadences and these different levels of performative quotation to a point where they're taking on female characters. They're taking on other characters in their neighborhoods. They're taking on brothers and sisters, and it's not a form of imitation, you know, or it's not an impression. These things seem realistic, and that's how he, I think, is one of the ways in which he was able to talk about elements of vulnerability within his community, or as a rap artist talk about his own personal vulnerabilities, without fear or shame of being retaliated against in the culture that he's speaking for and from. So he really opened the door. You know, Lamar's somebody that I've obsessed over before the PhD process, but just being able to see how he has revised the game, you know, especially West Coast rap, just revised it, you know, addressed problematic tropes or addressed traditions and made people rethink how, what they were celebrating previously. You know, oh, I used to celebrate that element of the music. Now Lamar's kind of made me rethink it, like, what if I really was involved in that? How would I really feel? You know, that's groundbreaking, you know. And you hear some, like in academia, you hear some people saying that Lamar is problematic in his own ways, but I always have to rep him because of how groundbreaking he, you know, the amount that he's done artistically. I think it's unrivaled. It's unprecedented, you know.
Do you think that the Joe public, Do you think they subconsciously connect to that quality of Kendrick? Do you think they know what they're actually dialed into and love about it? Do they think that deep, you think?
I think, it's a dangerous game to play, isn't it? When you're an artist of that high grade, I think you probably have to play it down slightly. You probably have to play both ends of the scale. So your label is saying, where's the single?
Yeah.
But you've made this deeply complex piece of high culture, and then you're pushing, like, okay, well, we need to push for a single. But even in the singles of, you know, the recent album, Mr. Morale, the singles, they contain profound lyrics. Look at the beginning of his studio album career, like a breakout single like Swimming Pools. Swimming Pools was deep. Like, it spoke about alcoholism or drug addiction in the community and in the family circles that he was from.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, you can equate somebody like Lamar to Shakespeare, which is it's a big leap, and it's also a rubbish link, because, you know, somebody like Shakespeare is out the picture in comparison to modern day. But, you know, somebody still who is lauded as being important and championed on the literary circuit. But you can equate somebody like Lamar because of what he does on something like Swimming Pools. Is he subverts meaning? So for me and you, we might be in a dance club thinking, oh, Swimming Pools, I love this track, and just vibing to it and enjoying it. But somebody else who might have family members who are suffering from alcoholism, they're able to go, oh shit, Lamar's talking about a subject matter that I relate to. Yeah. So you go much deeper with your lyrical content. The guy's been doing that since maybe before his early 20s.
Yeah, so I remember that. He had that song with the saxophone. I can't remember the name of it, but it's just like heavy, you know, upfront riff. Almost, and he's rapping, almost playing alongside the sax. Like,
oh, yeah.
Do you remember this
for
tune?
Free.
Yeah, that's
I wrote about it. Studied that as well. There's some scholars have written about that, about how it's, it is a... Sometimes it's significant. You know, there's an idea that all rappers should be really technically gifted, and when they move over a rhythm, you got to be strict, hit every beat, you know, every syllable has to be meticulous. But there's much more. Like, you look at artists like Kendrick Lamar, who's opened the door for this again. But then you got artists like Mike, sometimes Navy Blue. There's a bunch of them, Marvy, there's others. And at times, they will, it's almost a deliberate thing that they'll non-align with the beat. They'll kind of go out of flow of the beat. And sometimes you know, people have to start realizing that that isn't a sign that those MCs are whack. Mm. Like, it isn't a sign that they're not technically adept. What they're doing is they are putting feelings and that ideas and emotions over technical ability. You know, so sometimes when you say something that's so important to you, you might go out of pocket. Mm. You know, the emotion might be there, but you might be out of pocket. And that is being embraced more and more by the younger generations, that idea that they no longer want to justify that they can rap by being really technically adherent and being able to spit like a robot. It's not about that anymore. It's about finding these, like, holistic or these like almost hallucinogenic loop patterns that they're rhyming in. And then they just sit over a beat that evokes an emotion, but they're not following that beat. To me, I it takes me a long time to work out what they're doing. So, you know, there's, yeah.
Ooh, yeah, it does, doesn't it? I know exactly what you're talking about. And flow, some, you know, when I hear people like Pav, big up Foreign Beggars, you know, Pav, and he lays on that beat something crazy. To the point where it's like, dude, what he's doing is so frantic, but yet so laid back vocally. Big up Sonny Jim as well, because he's another one that just really just, you know, he's, you know, he got that blaxploitation air about his bars, and he's, he's really just delivering those one-liners each time. Dang, 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 dang.
Yeah.
Then there's the whole flip side, Dirty South. And like you said, the new generation at the moment, it almost sometimes, the way they rap is almost like in front of the beat.
Almost
like, it doesn't feel quite correct.
Yeah.
And you're like, jarry. But I'm still trying to get my head around that.
Yeah, yeah.
What is that?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's just different flows for different generations. I think since the internet age, that's come in, almost hitting the beat early, and then people start to find all of a sudden there's a generation who think, well, that's completely whack, that's out of time. But then there's the newer generation of thinking, that's how I want to put bars in now.
Yeah.
You know, almost as if your acapella's been put a little bit shifted.
Ever so slightly.
Yeah. But then that's what I think is amazing. It goes back to that lyrical performative quotation thing, that the other generations, new generations, they don't necessarily want to be what we were. And that part of that is a bit boring. You know, it's when you think about it, you equate it to that idea that you don't want to do what your parents are doing. You want to, if your parents are coming in really late on the beat and snapping like a Dilla, you know, like that Dilla snap, you think, yeah, okay, that's fair enough, but I don't want to do what my dad did or my mum did. I'm coming in early. I'm dropping in early. I'm going to change the game.
Yeah.
And then you change the game. But what? Just going back to artists in particular, like Mike, and there are some artists from London that I've heard as well, you know, from England, who do this, but they are far more preoccupied with the poetics and the semantics within their vocabulary, their delivery, than whether they're rhyming. They're rhyming heavily. An artist like Earl Sweatshirt is rhyming ridiculously, but it's the semantics, it's the symbolics and the feelings within the words, the symbolism in the words that count for a lot more than hitting the beat right, you know. So there's a lot, like, I think the next generation is going to be far more poetically minded, you know, feelings over technical adherence. That's what I write about in one of the chapters. You know, you can hear it happening, you know.
Crazy. As you were talking, and you know, phonetics, and you know, some MCs just inherently throw so many words into a bar. I remember when Company Flow came out. Now, this is a golden time. It was so informative for us, right? LP, you know, he single-handedly kind of presented coordinates of lyrical dexterity.
Yeah.
You know, his performances on record were just like, dude, like, you know, you had to go and get a dictionary. Felt like you were learning something every track. And then that opened up like Virtuoso. Do you remember that MC Virtuoso?
No, I'm not sure.
Dude, there was a whole bunch of, you know, backpacker era kind of MCs that were really throwing science at it. Then Cool Keith came with Dr. Octagon, more mm-hmm. science.
Yeah.
What was your take on that at its time?
You know what? I mean, I've when it comes to all of that, in truth, I'm much more of a commercial listener. So, you know, I followed those more commercial artists. So I tried to listen for Company Flow. I think they were ahead of their time to a point where I just wasn't ready.
You weren't ready for it
at the time.
Wow,
yeah.
Okay.
But you know, I know where you're making that link from what I'm talking about. Yeah. But to Company Flow, an artist like that, it's something that I need to go back and do my homework on. But yeah, I think you're right. That, you know, those were the pioneers of what I'm talking about. Mm. You know, not necessarily purposefully not doing what everybody else is doing. You know, you can even put Outkast in that.
100%.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow, yeah.
You know, but so I was much more commercially minded for most of my career, but it's, you know, it's now I'm a little bit older that I'm starting to realise, you know, the importance of those artists who are breaking the mould.
I'm going to say something, and this is my musing, so I want your response to it. So, mumble rap, I love, in the same way I love thrash metal. Vocalists, because I don't necessarily need to hear what they're saying. It's a feeling.
Yeah, it's a feeling. Yeah, yeah. There you go.
Yeah,
yeah. It's that thing about, you know, music doesn't always have to. You should never have to always have to have a dictionary nearby.
Yeah.
Like you might have to do that with my lyrics sometimes. Yeah. You know, like, oh, Capo's talking about something complex. Okay, I don't really want to listen to that at the moment. I'm not in the mood for that. I just want to hear somebody. Just put feelings over the beat. That's something I would love to be able to do.
Yeah.
Just put feelings over the beat. You know, different artists, different strokes for different folks, different artists for different times in your life.
Mm.
Company Flow for one time when you really want to think and you want to have that in the back of your mind. But then when you just want to let go and just enjoy, sometimes you want an artist, say, like Playboi Carti.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You want to listen to that and just vibe out.
All right, so on that note then, you know, music for endurance. You're about to jump into a cold bath for 3 minutes. What 3-minute song would you put on?
Music for endurance.
Yeah.
I think it's called You Don't Know by Jay-Z. It's what I've been listening to recently.
Yeah.
Because going back to the beginning of this podcast, that idea that I haven't been able to write for a month or so, I know that my mind is starting to veer off into those dark areas. So, you know, what I'll do often is play the same song over and over in order to lift myself out of that. You know, for a certain time, whatever I'm doing, if I'm taking a journey or a walk or I'm traveling, I'll play that same song because it keeps me in that same place. Do you do that? Do you ever repetitively play the same song or the same piece of music?
Yeah, I think
a lot of people do.
Yeah.
You know, and as a shameless piece of promotion for my new album, Canon, the initial track from the LP is called Pain. It deals with that idea of how do people deal with pain as a concept, but also that idea of latent trauma, you know. How do you get yourself out of those clouds, or when the rain is falling in your life, metaphorically, how do you get yourself out of those clouds? One of the things that I've always managed to be able to do is just keep a headphone in, play the same song on repeat. It doesn't have to be like an uplifting track. It just needs to put me in the right place. That's my medicine. So you're literally injecting, you know, consistently for hours. So you're keeping yourself there. And I think people do it. And that's why
I think a lot of people do it if they go into war. You know, the people have these songs and they literally just have them repeat. And it acts as almost like a mental a drill, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right.
That's crazy.
Yeah. That's a cool thing to think about like that. Yeah. Maybe they do. I mean, I don't know. I've got no evidence of that. But my evidence is myself. When I'm in that bunker mentality, when I'm kind of my back's against the wall, I'll put something on like Jay-Z's You Don't Know. Mm. You know, he says, what does he say in that song? It's like the epitome of that hustler mentality where, you know, when you have issues in your life, you will get through it. You will win regardless because you're a resilient person. He says, I want to get it right. But he said, what does he say? I sell ice in the winter. I sell fire in hell. I am a hustler, baby. I sell water to a well. I know that that's not like the most complex line, but it just means a lot to me because it's about that. Put me anywhere on God's green earth, I'll triple my worth. You know, whatever it takes, you will be that. You know what is needed. You have what is required within you.
Yeah.
I like the thought of that. But just going back to my LP, the pain track, I tried to make that in the guise of if somebody's going through that bunker mentality or they're feeling what I call out of alignment with the world. You know, because we all do. We go through those moments when you're out of alignment with the world, and for whatever reason, you sometimes it's impossible to get yourself back on track. You just got to wait it out. You know, and have faith that you will get back in alignment with the world. I made the pain track just in case somebody wanted to have something like that to use as their medicine. You know, for me, that's the biggest thing now. You know, get to a certain point in your life and it's about giving back as much as possible. Yeah, so
100%.
Yeah, you do all this studying, you got this passion for this music, and then it's like, well, I have to give this to someone now. You know, somebody might benefit from what I know. So it's about being able to sufficiently give back, you know, whatever I've got to give.
Life is all about the many lives that you have within it, and some songs just last the whole duration of your life. But from a creative point of view, you know, some of the most hardest pieces of trauma, like, you know, being on the motorway for 3.5 hours going to the Killer Keller podcast. I jest. You kind of need to go through them, and putting that across in music can often be tough. I guess the point you're making is that, you know, to give that, put that pain into a track or put that love into a track, and it serves very much like, you know, swimming pools for Kendrick.
Yeah.
You know? It's a real, it's a hard job, but someone's got to do it, right?
Yeah. And I assume that Kendrick Lamar from early on knew that he had a message, like he was a catalyst for an important message for the people around him first and then for the world. And, you know, it took me, like I was saying about other elements of my career, sometimes it takes longer for people than others. It took me a long time to realise that I'm kind of like, I could be some type of catalyst for change for somebody else. I could be a vessel for a message to deliver. So, you know, so when I get the chance, I want to be able to do something like that without it sounding too cliche or, you know, too cheesy.
You ever watched, there's this program in England, it was particularly in the 90s, I remember watching it, Football Grandstand, you know, Match of the Day, these sort of programs.
Lynham.
And there's always there was this Scottish guy that always used to be on. And you didn't have to like football, but his passion for it. You're just like, yeah, I've got to give it to the guy. If I, you know, he really loves this shit.
Yeah.
And I really hope this is resonating in the podcast because you're that guy. You're like, you
definitely got a passion for the art form. Definitely.
Where does it come from? Where does that come from, Capo?
I don't know, man. It's just within. I think in some ways, I think it just felt, it fell. I'm more than likely, if I was from the 70s, it might have been progressive rock or something like that.
Yeah.
Or I don't know. I think I just fell in that era. I think, you know, I think I'm just obsessive over it. To a fault at sometimes, you know, it causes
What's
issues.
What's the Mrs. thing? Well, I mean, she must have always seen.
We tend to, like, I will talk about, you know, elements of my career, probably too much. She'd tell you too much, but in some ways, I try to keep that separate. You know, I try to keep my artistic life separate. I always have for some reason.
Because
it's so close to me, I think. I don't like to feel, I don't know. But yeah, I'm pretty certain that she would tell you that I talk about it too much.
Really, you think?
I think so, yeah.
Comment below, people, you know who you are. this is why they love us, isn't it? You've got to have a thing, isn't it? You know, something that really, you know, keeps you alive.
I think so. I was going to say something. Yeah, I want to be as truthful as possible, and I know there's statistics out there about, you know, you hit a middle age especially men, you hit a middle age. And I think, you know what you're saying about the idea that it's important to have a passion, because I think you hit a middle age as a man and you start to realise, you know, Hemingway talks about this. You start, you're walking down the street, not that this was ever me, I was never this person, but you start to realise you get into a certain point where the maybe the females or whoever you're interested in, they don't look at you anymore because you're of an age where you're out of that remit now. And then what do you hold on to? Do you know what I mean? I'm not just saying life is all about that, relationships and attractions, but what I'm saying is you get to a certain age, your kids get old enough that they don't necessarily need you too much. What do you have? Like and I think it's important to have this passion. I think for me, it's huge for me to have that passion, something that I can back into when I've got that bunker mentality, when I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, what have I got ahead of me and what's behind me? Sometimes it's overwhelming to feel like that. Yeah. I get that. And I'm not just... I'm talking from a masculine perspective. I'm talking from a male perspective because that's all I know.
Yeah.
But I think females of our age group, more than, you know, women of our age group, they probably feel the same. But I know there's high statistics, you know, suicide rates in men of this age. Mm-hmm. And maybe a part of that, the way that I see it, is due to that idea that, you know, those passions aren't there. They're not nurtured, perhaps. You don't feel like you got that passion, whereas maybe for us, we're lucky because we have a passion that I know that whether I make money or not off this passion, if I go to the outhouse and I write to a beat that's correct for me, I'm going to resonate with it and it's going to help my heart. It's going to help my soul.
Back into its feedback.
It's feedback, yeah. I spoke to somebody who was this was a number of years ago, but they were a practitioner, a dance practitioner. I don't think they studied hip-hop as an art form, but they were from, I think it was the Arts Council England, you know, an organisation like that. Mm. And obviously they were part of the governing body, so they had this upfront, you know, this kind of a stiff demeanour. But afterwards, I was saying to them, you know, I understand that your job comes first nowadays, like a lot of people's does, you know, finances come first, family comes first and all that. But I was like, what about your passion? And she said, look, I was telling her I was worried about my passion. Like, I don't know, can I put a PhD first and foremost, or can I put, you know, an academic job first and foremost, say, ahead of my music? What's going to happen to my music? So I was panicking. But she said, you know, she gave me that advice that I was trying to pass on. Then she was like saying, you know, most days after all of the organisational, the regimented elements of her professional life are done, that's when she heads to the studio. And that's when she still cultivates that passion. That's how she refreshes and renews every day. And identifying that and then realising that, you know, that is going to be consistent in your life. Nobody can take that away. You know, a lot of people say that about music. You know, you can choose your family. You can't choose your family. Perhaps you can choose your friends, but, you know, you can get hurt in many different ways with being a human being. But one thing that I can rely on is music. You know, that's always got my back. Like, no matter what, I can always find something I can rely on.
Yeah, you're right. And not a lot of people have that.
Or maybe they do, but they just haven't identified it.
Identified it, yes.
And I'm saying that to middle-aged men. I think identify, it doesn't have to be music. Your passion can be anything.
Yeah, yeah.
But to get you out of that trench, or whatever you want to call it metaphorically, to get you out of that area where you're out of alignment and you know, there's whatever's going on in your life. For everybody, it's different. But I think a lot of people will understand that place. Mm. Yeah, a lot of people have been down that road. To have something where you can
zoom in
and do it religiously, like almost piously, adhere to that practice. You know, give yourself to that practice.
Living, that allows you to live in the moment, a level of stoicism. Oh,
being in the presence, man. Yeah, being in the present. I love that idea.
Yeah.
Being in the present as much as possible. Do you think we are in the present now?
100%. We're right here, right now. Yeah. It's stoic.
Yeah.
Well, that's what you're really... I think you're very much all about that, Capo. I feel like you're in the present with a high level of stoicism, a sense of zen. You know, your dial must be pretty much on the floor in presence when you're writing. I would imagine getting you out of that is probably a tough call for you.
Yeah, I think so. I would say being in the present is like when I watch my son play football, I imagine him to be completely in the present. You know, when there's you're in a competitive environment and all you have to think about is that one thing. I think that's in the present. Maybe for me and you, it would be performing on stage. You know, there's an expectancy of you and then you're in the present. You're only thinking about doing the best you can with the craft that you've trained yourself in. I think that's when you're really entirely in the present. And you know, you said it. The more you can be in that present, the more the future, the past doesn't have any weight anymore. You're living in that moment.
When you're in that moment, I visualize you in. I visualize your head moving like. I'm going deep on this one. You know when people do Rubik's Cube really fast?
Right, yeah.
I think that's a mental equivocal of your head when you're flipping words.
I wouldn't say that. I'm trash at Rubik's Cubes. I can't.
No, but I mean like a mental, you know, like I think of a sandstorm when I hear Harry Shotter just barring off.
Right.
It's just like intense.
Right. For you, it's almost a sick image.
A Rubik's Cube. You is like click, click, unlock, 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 unlock.
I like that image to represent me, but I don't think that's the true me. I think
you don't think so.
No,
I see it like that.
I'm glad you do. I like the fact that hopefully my lyrics have portrayed that. You know, I've projected that image to you of being this.
Yes.
You know this. Almost superhuman, cerebral,
click, thinking.
But
what do you say? Okay, so if you were to have an avatar, you know, what is the Capo avatar?
Xavier.
Really?
Yeah, they got the same. Who else would it be? Yeah, Yul Brynner.
Okay.
Anybody with the same haircut as me.
Yeah. You know?
But yeah, Xavier, and that goes back to that idea of being. You know, complex with the lyricism, things like that. You know, complex with the terminology and needing a dictionary when you listen to Capo. It's not the coolest thing to be, but you know, I rely on it now. You know, I've found in recent years reading a book right close. If I have the time, if I read something, then a lot of the time it will translate into the lyrics that I write. So. I'm working. So, yeah, I mean, thinking about canon, there's a lot of, like, literary references in there. So there's a track called Light Switch on the first chapter. So canon comes in three chapters.
That's right, yeah.
So it's got the first one, and it speaks of this journey that I've been elaborating on a little bit. But that idea that the first chapter is a kind of an EP's worth of an idea of a person articulating what pain is to them and that idea of latent trauma and how they're dealing with that from different angles or perspectives. But then you come to the second chapter, which is all about that idea of using an art form or a process as a form of escapism from that pain or that latent trauma that you're dealing with. And then finally the third chapter is a representation of when a person resolves and understands that and, you know, is conscious of the fact and aware that those things might not necessarily go away, but you're coming to terms with them. You know, you're learning to mature, to understand that the pain is a constant, but it doesn't define you. You know, that idea. But yeah, so a lot of I lean on a lot of literature in the lyrics. So that leads back to a song like Light Switch. I talk about Ishmael Reed and his text. They're all allusions, you know. That I just make references to them in the hopes that anybody who has read or knows about Ishmael Reed, they'll make that link and go, okay. And I think And then maybe I will link it with Gene Rees and a text like Voyage in the Dark, but then I might link, you know, that up with Hemingway again, you know. But I think it's art, a lot of art, whether it's painted or written or performed, vocalized. I think a lot of it is like calling out to for somebody else to go, I feel that. Mm. Like I completely understand where you're coming from with that. You know, so yeah, a lot of my bars are sometimes they lean on proverb quite a lot, you know. Mm. I can't think of a proverb, but you know, like into each life some rain must fall. You know, I say that early on in the pain chapter. Mm. Because it's a long term way that many people in the human race have articulated that sign, that's that element of life, which is, you know, into each life, everybody's gonna feel some rain. Nobody is gonna get through in all the sunshine. You know, even if they tell you that, they have experienced rainfall. So into each life, some rain must fall. It really summarizes, it captures that whole element of
That's why social media is such a facade. Do you know what I mean? Because it only shows the sunshine. Never shows the fucking rain.
The
depth in where you're going with this right now, bro. Like, you're an artisan right now. You know what I mean? Like, these are real deeper than deep. You break down each line by line and the influences.
Yeah. You know? I want to do that more. Breaking down lyrics, I think, is important for me now because...
To the word, to the syllable.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to do it at that granular detail. So in relation to Canon, it's the first project. You know, speaking of artisans, I have to shout out Kong the Artisan, you know, the producer of Canon.
Come on,
so a long-term friend of yours, an affiliate, you know, musical affiliate. So you guys go back way longer than me, but... I have to shout him out because he is one of the people who was, he was the one who encouraged me to have that side of myself where it's like, look, embrace the fact that you've worked hard at this show and then show people the value in what you do.
Yeah.
Like, it's a painstaking process for me. I don't just throw these things out. Like,
no, to package it is a, yeah. It's a,
to put everything together, to put the lyrics, to try and combine illusions and... Over literary techniques into the work, and sometimes, you know, to find out what I'm doing, you know, to find out about yourself. It's a long process for me, and I think it's valid now. I feel like I want it to be valid that I can break it down a little bit more. You know, if I put a verse out there, then maybe later on I will break it down. Like, I will put it into context about what it truly means and what it's engaging with, you know, technically. And that seems to have helped, you know, the promotion with Canon on social media when I've broken it down. Like, I've got an artist called Lee Scott on a track called Badlands, which is the last track on the escapism element of the album.
Okay, we'll look forward to that.
Go on. So, the first chapter is out now, and hopefully when people get to hear this podcast, all of the chapters will be out on DSPs, you know, on streaming platforms by then. So you'll be able to go and listen. But I'm planning on continuing with my social media, especially on Instagram. I plan on continuing trying to break down the verses, you know, trying to have some critical analysis going on of what I'm trying to do, because if I don't do it, nobody's going to. Like, I've got to, sometimes you have to champion your own work. Even I'm a big advocate of putting art out there and letting other people decide whether it's good, but at this moment in time, I need to be able to get a grasp of music as a business too, and you have to be able to promote yourself. You have to be able to talk about yourself and value your work. So whereas in the past many releases have gone by where I put my heart and soul into it. I genuinely put my heart and soul into it. I can honestly say that. But then after I've released it, I don't talk about it. You know, it's done for me. My part of it is done. Let other people perhaps dissect.
Swan be a swan. Let it go.
Yeah. So in so much as that, I think that's fair. And I would like to be able to do that. But if I want to try and create this legacy and I want to try and solidify that legacy, perhaps it's down to me to really show what I'm doing in some of the verses. So for something like Badlands with Lee Scott, recently I put up a few comments, you know, like a mini essay, say, of what I'm doing in the verse, you know, it's to show the depth, to prove the depth in the work, you know. So,
I mean, to have you on a podcast, I mean, it's going forever. I just... ebbs and flows in how you think. And yeah, it's just too much, bruv. You're too much, my guy.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity of speaking about myself.
I've been a fan from the jump, and you know, this won't be the last. And the future is bright, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing that I really want to emphasise. I'm really happy with the way that this interview has gone, because I think there's nothing wrong with being nostalgic and looking upon a person's past and, you know, celebrating that. I think that's amazing.
Mm.
But for me, I feel like another part of my career is just beginning.
Yeah, it is,
where
yeah.
I found myself, I'm able to objectify my music, I'm able to then speak about it in full. I want to elaborate on these concepts and these topics that we talk about. I want to shine a light on other artists and on how they've influenced me. You know, I just want to be more verbal in my career. And I feel like, you know what is good inside is, yeah, I've been away studying a PhD. I've done a lot of learning involved in that. But now I feel like I'm back and I want to be prolific and I want to work and collaborate and I want to inspire further, and I feel like I got that energy and that hunger to do it, you know. So reaching this age is a point for some artists. They'll make it clear that you reach a certain age like this as a rap artist, then what are you still doing rapping? You should be an entrepreneur now, investing in stocks and shares. You know, a lot of big artists, they talk like that. Case in point is
50 Cent, maybe.
50 Cent, but also a recent case in point is Andre 3000 talking about, you know, it's like, I'm a grown... I can't say the exact quote, but I think he's something around the lines of, look, I'm a grown man. What am I going to talk about as a rap artist? I think he has a lot to talk about, like we all do. As artists, we grow.
Yeah.
You don't just stop because it's an art form like rap music.
Yeah.
Look at Black Thought.
Yeah.
Oh, the person like that is going to go on forever, man. Like,
only in this podcast can we say these dons so on the money. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
What would the culture have done if he hadn't delivered?
Yeah, yeah.
The age he's at
so
now.
So many times. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, he's a representative of somebody who I deem, I don't know what his age is, but I deem him a generation before me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But this guy's still a beast, still hungry.
Higher echelon.
I would assume, yeah, a higher echelon, and I would assume he has something within him that is innate, like he has to write.
Yeah.
It's an obligation, and I'm not demeaning Andre 3000's perspective, because I get that too, but I'm just saying I'm from that field, or I'm from that place where it's required in me, it's needed, and I feel like going forward, hopefully, you know, me and Kong the Artisan have talked about the sequel to Canon and taking what we've created as this platform and just moving it forward. And I'm excited about the idea of working with live musicians, working with more collaborations, you know, thinking about melodies and song form, as well as just trying to put 32, 36 bars in a row. It's more about, okay, what can I do now to move someone, you know, to change their perspective or their angle on life. What concepts am I now going to bring at this age? What can I speak upon? You know, the other thing we were saying earlier is about Lamar bringing all these characters into his work. Can I do that? You know, what's to say, how could I speak in another cadence or another tone? My whole career is about that concept of keeping it real. That hip-hop mentality, keep it real, speak about where you're from, be exact with your accent, all of that. What about if there's a way that I could write something completely different in a concept album?
I can add value to that one and say Prince.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he had a way of feminizing. Feminizing?
Yeah.
He had a character, didn't he? And he pitched the vocal up. I would say Andre did that as well.
Yeah.
On Lamar, Love Below.
I think the greats are the greats they can.
They just do, yeah.
Feminizing. I need to start to learn to feminize. Like, but I would find it difficult to speak from a female perspective.
Yeah.
You know, I think you could get away with it if you're talking about a character, but even then it becomes problematic if you're a man trying to speak from a woman's perspective. Mm. But, you know, on the other hand, if I was to hear somebody like Lil Sims speak from a male perspective, I think it's valid. I think I would respect that angle. I would respect, you know, I'd like to hear, because it gives you that insight.
Mm.
You know, it gives you what are your expectations of what does a a woman, when they embody a man, what do they speak about? What are the first things they think about? Mm. It gives you that, what they preconceive as being the male experience. Mm. And I'm all for that, you know. Mm. I think now I'm older, it's about pushing boundaries. It's about, you know, letting people live and allowing things, allowing people to say what, as long as they're not hurting anybody.
And extending one's dynamism, you know.
Yeah.
Where can that feminine side go? Where can that male side take?
Yeah.
Really opens the drawers out of how you are. Yeah. We are as great people.
Yeah, I think so, man. There's many. The greats can do that. Yeah. The greats can take on characters.
Vulnerability.
Yeah, the greats can show their vulnerability and help others.
Yeah.
You know, so that's something that I want to take forward. But just working with other people and still being inspired by younger generations, you know. And it's good that you talked about mumble rap in that way. I don't even know the term mumble rap. I think that's derogatory in some ways,
absolutely,
isn't it? But I know what you mean, and it's used all the time now.
I threw it out there intentionally.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean.
Because it's such a passé, flippant thing to, you know, fucking tarnish a generation. Do you know what I mean? Taking reference to thrash metal and that guttural...
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Oiness, no, I get about, that. You know, that...
Yeah, I've never heard that. I've never heard somebody make those similarities, but I think it's true.
I think it exists mainly in English rap. American using the English... Because when I hear a German MC or an Italian MC, you ain't checking for lyrics like that.
Yeah.
You're listening to... It's like Coltrane.
Yeah,
Miles Davis.
It's different. Yeah, it's like their voice is an instrument, then, isn't it? Because you can't understand what they're saying.
Yeah. So when people talk on that mumble rap shit, it's like fuck that.
It's an instrument.
Yeah.
We're
you know, we're really checking for it like that, and it's important. Or else we're not thinking universally.
Yeah.
We're not thinking outside the box, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think that's one of the main issues. I never want to be stuck like that. Yeah. You know, hating on newer generations, and I respect the purists too. I respect people who, you know, they have a lot of care for tradition and how things should be done. I get that. But I also want to let younger generations live. Like, let them live. Let them be what they need to be. Because otherwise, how are you going to... How's anything going to progress? You know?
Oh, well, that's a whole nother conversation. Yeah. Right? I mean, you know, reversing words and stuff like that. You know, who knows what the future will bring us, you know?
Yeah.
Well, my brother, it's in safe hands with Capo, that's for sure. Thank you so much for joining us, man.
No, thank you, Keller. Thank you for letting me speak.
Real talk right here. And if that doesn't inspire you, you have been... I don't know where you are in the world. Do you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't matter whether it's MCing or any element of the creative arts. Just get in and dial in and zen. Go in. Killer Keller podcast. Out like in was out of fashion. Capo's here. Listen, stay lucky, people. Don't talk to anyone I wouldn't. Crime don't pay, and neither did I. So keep on doing what you're doing, all right? Be lucky. Peace.